Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 07-755. Howard University Appellant, Metropolitan Campus Police Officers Union. Mr. Harris, the appellant. Mr. Jepson, for the appellee.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Keith Harrison. I'm with the law firm of Kroll & Mooring, and myself and my partner, Trina Fairley, have the distinct pleasure, the privilege of representing Howard University before this honorable court.
Did you represent them in the negotiations?
No, we did not. They were represented by in-house counsel during the negotiations. This is a case about fundamental fairness. Howard University was denied a fair hearing because the arbitrator refused to hear testimony that was clearly dispositive. This court has recently, the most recent case in which this court has reviewed a decision of an arbitrator is Lesson versus Merrill Lynch. It's at 41 F3rd 813.
Before we get to the law part, if I could see if I can understand the fact part. Very what well. Exactly did you want Klein to testify about?
Klein, the chief negotiator for the union, as set forth in a declaration at the appendix at page 62 and 63, was going to testify about statements she made to the chief negotiator for the union.
That's the only thing. Statement.
That's the only thing.
Well, then, in your brief, it's confusing to me because in the reply brief it said she was going to elicit her understanding of the union's intent and the representations. Now, when you say the union's intent, you mean only as expressed vocally to the other side? Or do you mean with respect to what she knew by discussions with her client?
The former.
Only the words that were spoken to the other side.
Only the words that were spoken to the other side.
Right, so that means there was somebody on the other side who those words were spoken to, right?
Yes.
And that person was
Mr. Leroy Jenkins.
Mr. Jenkins.
Yes.
Yep. And did he testify?
He did.
Well, then somebody testified to this, and by excluding her, and she represented the opposite side from you, there was nobody in the alternative. So you have one side, your side, expressing what was said. Why is that a violation of due process or unfairness to be able to put on only your witness as to what was said?
Because there were two pieces to the puzzle. The issue was whether there was a meeting of the minds as to the inclusion of Appendix C as part of the contract.
Right, but the minds that we're talking about here are minds as expressed out loud, right?
Yes.
So if Jenkins testified that Klein said we're going to defer this issue, that's an expression of the meeting of the minds between the two of them. Why do we need to have Klein say, I agree, that's all I said? Well, if you have two witnesses to the same event and one of them testifies in your favor in the way you want that person to testify, why do you need a second witness to testify the same way?
Your Honor, with regard to Ms. Klein's testimony, her testimony would have been an admission on the part of the union.
No, it wouldn't have been. It would have been a statement about what she, as an observer or speaker, actually said. But you already had Jenkins saying that. Did the arbitrator not believe? Did the arbitrator believe that Jenkins was lying as to what Klein said?
There's nothing in the record that would suggest that. That was not the finding of the arbitrator. Right. Certainly, the arbitrator, there's no indication in the arbitrator's ruling with regard to any credibility assessment contrary to Mr. Jenkins.
Let me give the hypothetical.
Nor was his testimony credited in any respect with regard to any statement by Ms. Klein.
I understand that, but let's say the issue was what happened in this courtroom today. and you speak, and Mr. Jepson speaks. And in a later trial, we don't allow you to testify, or some judge doesn't allow you to testify, but Mr. Jepson, or put it another way, we don't allow Jepson to testify, but you can testify. Why is that, does that violate some sense of fairness by having you alone? Maybe Jepson can complain, but why should you complain if your speech, if your testimony about what happened is accepted?
If there is no indication in the record that my testimony about what was said was even considered.
Well, that's a different question. So that's not the exclusion of testimony. That's the usual problem with arbitrators' opinions, which is that they don't explain everything. And normally we let that go by.
Well, I would suggest that in this case, if there's an admission, and I would submit that it would be an admission if a chief negotiator and an agent for a union says that during negotiations, I said, and I'm quoting, during open negotiations, the parties agreed to continue negotiating over the wage compensation package.
When she says an admission, it happened then, right, back at the negotiations, not in her testimony.
But
in her testimony, she is simply a witness to what happened at the negotiations.
And she's no longer an agent.
She wasn't even an agent to make an admission, exactly, at the time of the arbitration.
At the time of the testimony, she wasn't.
Time of the testimony.
Right.
Which is at the arbitration. The negotiation, she was an agent. By the arbitration and testimony, she's a witness.
That's correct, but...
So it would not be an admission by a party or anybody else. She would simply be relating what had happened, which may or may not have been an admission, back at the time of the negotiation. Isn't that correct?
Well, certainly her testimony would have been, I believe, dispositive on the issue of whether there was a meeting.
Well, it couldn't have been more than corroborative. You already had the evidence in through the other witness. The witness from your party, Howard. The evidence is already there. That might have been very strong corroboration, but it would not have introduced anything new, would it?
Well, there was certainly the ruling of the arbitrator was that, in fact, there was a meeting of the minds, and it was in no respects based on any statement by Howard University. And, in fact, based on the arbitrator's decision, it appears there's no reference in the arbitrator's decision with regard to any statement by Howard University, and it is clear that the basis on which that testimony was excluded was not reasonable at all. There was no attorney-client privilege with regard to that statement.
With respect to the words expressed in front of Mr. Jenkins, that's all you're talking about, right? That is, there's no, you're saying there's,
yes,
no attorney-client privilege because all that she wanted to testify about were words she spoke in the presence of opposing counsel.
That's correct.
Okay, and nothing about her intent, her subjective intent, only about what she actually said.
Well, that would be the testimony, yes.
Which?
Her testimony would have been about what she said during the course of open negotiations.
Right.
Her testimony would have also been... important, and the only evidence with regard to the February 9th email that came subsequent to that, which continued, which from the university's perspective was evidence of the continued negotiations.
That was after the contract was signed, right?
Yes, that was after the contract was signed and reflected continuing negotiations. The arbitrator, in the absence of Ms. Klein's testimony, found it ambiguous.
Let me ask one last question.
Because it stood alone.
Okay, let me ask one last question about the,
yes,
facts. What did Jenkins say in his testimony about what Klein said?
The record does not reflect that.
Did Jenkins testify on that subject?
He did. I would hesitate to present to the court information that's not part of the record. But because there was no transcript and it was not reflected in the arbitrator's decision, there's nothing before this court that would indicate the substance of Mr. Jenkins' testimony.
These things aren't recorded or anything like that.
They were not in this instance, so there is no transcript. But the issue nevertheless remains that it was fundamentally unfair to make a decision based on the absence of evidence. Here, the arbitrator ruled that it was a unilateral mistake. that it was a unilateral mistake on behalf of Howard University. In the absence of Ms. Klein's testimony, the chief negotiator for the union, and that testimony would have demonstrated that it wasn't a unilateral mistake. Therefore, it was dispositive.
But the testimony, you keep saying it's dispositive, and yet you have told us nothing that it would have introduced that wasn't already before the arbitrator.
Certainly it would have introduced information with regard to the February 9th email, which would render it not ambiguous at all. And if Ms. Klein, the chief negotiator, had testified that during open negotiations, we agreed to continue negotiations, and the February 9th email was in fact those continued, additional evidence of those continued negotiations, then that certainly would have been new information.
Well, could she have testified about what her intentions were in sending that? Now we're not talking about what she actually said to someone. I'm talking about the email now. Mm-hmm. Now we're not talking about what she said to someone. We're talking about something that was in her mind and or something that she learned from talking with her client. That seems at least, I'm not sure what the right answer is, but that seems more debatable as an attorney-client issue.
Well, I think if she had been allowed to testify and the question would have been, what was the purpose of that email, I do not think that that would have in any way impinged upon the attorney-client privilege. The problem here is that evidence was excluded and there was never the opportunity for a fair hearing because the most important evidence, the most material evidence, was excluded and not allowed to be heard, which denied Howard University a full and fair hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Harrison.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm William G. Jepson, Jr. I'm a sole practitioner, and I represent appellee in this matter. I also represented appellee at the arbitration before arbitrator McKissick. I'd like to pick up on a point that counsel for the university argued, which is to say that they have argued before you that the judge, that the arbitrator ruled that there was a unilateral mistake on the part of the university. That's not the case. In fact, the arbitrator ruled that absent testimony from President Swigert, he knowingly and willingly signed it. There was no mistake. There was language in there where the arbitrator said this seemed to be a unilateral mistake, but in the final analysis, in the award, she held that President Swigert knowingly and voluntarily signed the document executing a contract, a valid and binding contract. With respect to the email, appellants have argued that the contents of the email is basically equivalent to the proffer as to what Ms. Klein would have testified per her declaration. I think the trial court in this matter correctly found that the email, no matter what the intent of it was, the email does not constitute a written statement of agreement between the parties that Appendix C was not agreed to, sufficient to affect the impact of an executed agreement signed by the parties on December 22nd and 23rd of 2003. Pursuant to that very document, only a written instrument could be considered, not oral statements in terms of the contents, deviating from the contents of the written word of the contract.
Zipper clause or something like that?
I'm sorry?
There's a zipper clause in the...
Yes, yes. It's the appellee's position that the parties met, the appellee filed a grievance, it was processed by the university, the grievance was denied, the matter was presented to an arbitrator, all without objection as to what the university has referred to as substantive arbitrability. The parties clothed the arbitrator with authority to decide the issue. They stipulated to the issue, again, without objection, and the arbitrator as well establishing case law, as well as the AAA, American Arbitration Association rules, the arbitrator, who's the authority, with respect to ruling on questions of evidence.
Well, what if the arbitrator had not allowed either Jenkins or Klein or anyone else to testify about anything said during the negotiations? What if that had happened? Would we not, at that point, say that there was an unfair proceeding? It's not the case that we have to accept every kind of ruling by the arbitrator, even if the arbitrator creates a situation where the hearing is totally unfair.
No, that's I agree. I mean, that's what the Bowles v. Stifel analysis goes to. You know, an opportunity to be heard, to present relevant material evidence and argument, and a bias-free decision. We agree with that.
Right. So if this testimony were key to the case and were excluded, then just because we typically allow arbitrators to decide evidentiary rulings wouldn't mean we would have to affirm. So why is this testimony of Klein, why wasn't it key to the case?
Well, the arbitrator found that the document itself represented an executed agreement, and then, you know, the applying, you know, what she called the objective law of contracts.
But she
the only thing to go behind there is the question of fraud, duress, or
mutual mistake.
Yeah,
she said she would accept evidence of mutual mistake if there were evidence of mutual mistake, right? And that could be used to reach a different result. The arbitrator didn't say. I mean, the arbitrator maybe could have said, this is objectively clear and unambiguous, and I'm not allowing extrinsic evidence, and that's the end of it. But instead, the arbitrator said, if there were evidence of mutual mistake, then we might undo this, but I don't find mutual mistake. Right?
Right.
Okay, so that means she has to fairly allow each side to prove, or fairly decide one side to prove mutual mistake and the other side to not prove it.
Sure, sir.
Right. So my question is, why wasn't Klein's testimony necessary for Howard to have a fair opportunity to prove mutual mistake?
Well, first off, there was no finding of a mistake on the part of the university. And although the appellant has argued that Ms. Klein was the best evidence as to the university's intent on its own execution of its document, we respectfully disagree. We believe that President Schweigert is fully competent to do that.
Imagine this hypothetical. Klein would have testified and Jenkins would have testified, both of them would have testified, that we agreed, we said what the meaning of this deal here is, that we're deferring the salary issues. That's our intentions. And they both spoke those intentions to each other during the period in which they were negotiating. Would that not be sufficient to provide evidence of mutual mistake? When they signed an agreement that appeared to not defer the issue?
I believe on this record, Your Honor, that all we have is a suggestion in this record that Ms. Klein's testimony would be nothing greater than a corroborative of Mr. Jenkins's testimony. Right. He was the chief negotiator for the university. His own testimony
It's not that this testimony is irrelevant. It's just that you don't need both of them.
Well, we argued that as well in our brief, Your Honor, about the duplicative testimony, and the arbitrator decided that it was simply, you know, obviously she decided for reasons noted and based on confidentiality.
You're not conceding that if she made an error in the relevance determination, that would be a good enough ground for us to reverse.
Oh, absolutely not.
Vacate the arbitration.
Absolutely not.
Okay, thank you. It is not, let me rephrase that. Is it abnormal for there to be no transcript of some or all of the evidence in an arbitration?
Between the parties, apparently their practice was not to transcribe.
Okay.
Other parties,
some do, and some don't.
Some do, some don't. In this case, they did not. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Case is submitted. Thank you both.